It's November 8th, 2022. Ward Green here. Good morning. 10:39 hours. Let's listen to a little more Oscar Peterson. And what comes after is an interview with Andre Previn.
Lovely, lovely, Oscar. There are many occasions when I'm glad that I'm a conductor, but never more than at this moment.
Don't say that.
Oh, no, it's true. It's true. That's lovely. That's lovely. Listen, before we even talk about anything, when you just lately started wanting to play alone a lot, as opposed to, you know, with a trio, what, any particular reason for that?
Well, yeah, there's several reasons, apart from any coercion from people like Duke Ellington and Norman Granz, was the fact that, as you well realize, it's one thing to play with a group in which there are certain restrictions and regimentations that you have to follow so that they know where you're at and you know where they're at, you hope. But also, selfishly, you know, when we play at home, as I'm sure you do, and we start experimenting with tunes, I know I've had the feeling that different times that I'd wanted to go possibly harmonically or rhythmically or melodically another way, even just for 2 bars, 4 bars. Mm. And some of these things that come across to me, you can't possibly transmit that quickly to a group, as you can realize. You're playing a tune and you agree, it's sort of a pact that we're going to play the tune this way, mm, within certain confines. And, you know, if I were to go out and, or you were to go out and suddenly take a left turn on a one-way street, you know, it becomes a little hazardous in the group, and what you end up with is dishevelment.
But you know, I mean, it's one thing to play alone as a classical pianist, obviously, but as a jazz pianist, when especially if you've been used for years to hearing, you know, bass and drums or bass and guitar, and all of a sudden you say, "What's this? Oh, it's a left hand, right? I remember this." Mm-hmm. You know, it must really get to be a hang-up.
Not for you, but it is. I think the left hand is in the things that I've, seminars that I've conducted in various parts of the world, this is the one hang-up that most pianists have, because, you know, it's sort of a quiet brainwashing process that takes place when a pianist gets in a group, right? Mm. And he has a good bass player and a good drummer, hopefully, or guitarist. And he's quietly brainwashed into using less and less of this, especially if he has a guitarist, because, you know, they start saying, "You're getting in my way. Don't play that much with your left hand." Mm. So he withdraws this, right?
Yeah.
And the first thing you know, suddenly, let's say it's a local pianist, he suddenly gets a job in a cocktail lounge, right? Now he's forced to play body and soul that he would ordinarily play like this, right? Yeah. And the bass player's going.
Right?
Yes. So constantly when he gets into the cocktail lounge, he starts playing, you know, the first playing might sound like a... those pianists, you know. Yeah. You know, you can tell right away, right?
I can even tell you who they are.
One thing is, we were talking earlier about some of the pianists, particularly Art Tatum. They had a way of, what's the word they use? Subliminally, musically making you hear something that they didn't play.
I was already worried about what I did hear.
Well, but Art could do this. Art could play, he would lead you down the garden path with a certain left hand procedure, let's say, and all of a sudden he wouldn't play like, he might play, then leave this one out and play, and according to how he voiced it, you would swear you'd automatically heard it, you know.
Well, even worse than that, I think that on some of those records I could hear a bass player, not a left hand, but an actual bass player, and he wasn't there.
That's what you call coming through, right?
Yeah. That's what I call
me now. Coming through.
That's funny, because I wasn't actually going to talk about Art yet, but I don't think it's possible to talk about jazz piano without talking about him. How far back was he an influence on you?
Well, Art Tatum came into my life, I can now say happily. At the time, I'd have to say unhappily, when I was in my teens, and I had, you know, not to make this a thing on me, but I know my first bruising with Art Tatum came at a very tender age in my teens, when my dad originally was in a very teens, and I had my first bruising with Art Tatum came at a very tender age in my teens when my dad originally was a sailor and taught himself organ and taught us piano, started us, and he farmed us out. And I got into the jazz thing, and I thought I was pretty heavy at school, you know. And then just going through, I'd play lunch hours and have all the chicks around the auditorium.
Good,
you know.
Good.
Well, the guys are all taking lumps playing football. I'm playing piano, right? And
things haven't changed.
That's right. And my dad was quietly watching all this. He was very quiet, and I never said too much. And I think somewhere in the back of his mind, he got the feeling that I was getting a little too egotistical about it. And one day he came home and he said, I got something I want you to hear, you know. I said, oh, yeah. He said, it's a record. I said, yeah, what is it? And he put on the record. I'll never forget, it was Art Tatum's Tiger Rag.
Oh, that's enough to kill you.
It almost did.
Yeah.
And truthfully, I didn't play piano. I gave up the piano for 2 solid months and had crying fits at night. I did. I was serious. You know, I really did. I can vividly remember, Andre, and I kid you not when I say this, other. I'd say, you know, you hear something that awesome, you say, well, first of all, it's 2 people. You know, right. When we got over that thing.
At least.
Yeah. Right? We got over that, my father said, uh-uh, one man. And when I believed him finally.
And he couldn't see, by the way.
You had to bring that up, right?
Yeah.
I'd go to bed at night, and it haunted me. Mm-hmm. It actually haunted me that someone could play the piano this well. You know, usually technique doesn't, I think you're a player yourself, you know, technique is technique. You refine it to a certain degree and you say, well, fine, he's a great technician. But to me, the thing with Tatum was the harmonic thought, the rhythmic thought, the change of cadence suddenly, you know. And I really had a bad time for 2 months, and finally I sort of sobered up and went
back. Did you try to imitate him after that?
No. Happily, no. I did. No. What I did was I listened, I still do, religiously. But I think, had I listened to Art Tatum, I would have become much the same as several pianists that I know in various parts of the world. And I had that same experience, and I'm glad I didn't, because I remember I first went down to, I'm called the city's name, so I won't hurt anyone, went down to the city, and it was the same old thing, you know, the piano thing is about so-and-so's in town, like the gunfighters, you know.
Yeah.
And after I did my concert, wherever it was, I was very young, I was 20, 21, they took me over to hear this pianist. And they said, you've got to hear this fellow. He's quite a pianist. So I said, great, love to hear him. He sat down. He said, play something for me. He played Man I Love, straight Tatum, note for note. You know. I figured, well, that's nice. He said, play something else. He played, Sweet Lorraine or something. Tatum. So finally I started thinking. I thought. And I think I asked him for, if I remember correctly, I've Got Rhythm, right? Yeah. And at that time, Art Tatum hadn't recorded I Got Rhythm.
Yeah.
And he couldn't play it. That's really a true story. He couldn't play it for the simple reason that he had to wait to see what God was going to say about the tune before he copied it. And he really couldn't. I kept, of course, I just said, well, you must know I Got Rhythm. He kept saying, no, I never played that tune. This is why I never copied. One of the major reasons I never copied Art.
See, with me it was different because I had an absolutely straightforward classical education, and when I went to America first, I thought that the jazz was, you know, a hotel band and funny hats, you know, what do I know? And that same thing happened. A fella came over and said, listen to this, and put on Sweet Lorraine. Now, I had a very methodical German father who was a music teacher, you know, and he knew how much I admired it, so he said, of course, carrying the logic one step forward, learn that. See? So I learned Sweet Lorraine. You know, I took it off the record, which took me maybe, 3 years. And and then, you know, and like you say, at the end of it, I still didn't know I Got Rhythm, right?
That's right.
But what's funny is that that is now, I guess about 30 years ago. Oh, yeah, 30 years ago. I bet I still know the first 8 bars.
Wait a minute.
Huh? That's right.
Now, I wanted to ask you something.
Yeah.
What did you feel like after you learned it?
Like a jerk, that's what. I mean, so what? I knew that. But all I really knew, all I had learned was that I couldn't really make that thing up. But that I had simply copied
that's
it.
The frustration.
Yeah, I was just taking tracing paper, you know, and copying a drawing. So, I mean, as far as that's concerned, I then, in essence, learned I got rhythm, you know, and went from there and played terribly badly for a while. But, I mean, the thing was to get away forcibly from that influence, first of all, because it's not good no matter what the influence is. And second of all, it's impossible.
Yeah, it's an overwhelming influence. I think not just art. If anyone admires a player that much and you start emulating them to that extent continually, it just overwhelms you. Then you negate any of your own personal creativity that you might have had that would come forward.
Did you meet him? Were you friends?
Yeah, we were very dear friends.
Now, I remember once, though. I remember walking into a club. I don't remember where. I think Detroit or something. And you were doing... I mean, you used to actually announce that you were going to play, like, a tribute to art. Mm-hmm. What was the tune that you used to do that to?
Ill Wind.
Ill Wind.
Yeah, Ill Wind. I did an arrangement I did on Ill Wind for art, and I recorded it quite a few years ago, as a matter of fact.
Well, if I remember the first 8 bars of that after 30 years, can you remember Ill
Wind? I'm not going to guarantee this.
Yeah. Try. An image of somewhere in the world trying to take that off.
Well, that's not hard. The strange thing about this particular thing, I was just thinking it again as I was playing, Andre, is that outside of this run,
yeah,
I don't think I could consciously play you a Tatum run. And I, as you asked me to play that, and as I was playing it, I was saying to myself, you know, this really isn't. It wasn't done really in the art. You couldn't really say that was Art Tatum's style. It was probably my reaction to Art Tatum.
That's the best kind of tribute, sure.
And I think this is the way possibly, you know, knowing players go. I did a tribute for Errol, which was much more stylistically inclined years later, because you can only do Errol Garner one way. But I don't mean that as anything.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't. No. Don't start.
Okay, all right.
But actually, with art, you know, it's amazing even in this day and age. Here's a man that has unfortunately passed away, and I still marvel at the fact that so many musicians, not just pianists, you know, still revere him so highly. And I think that's the greatest tribute to his genius that he could have.
You see, I also remember once that Horowitz. I mean, he used to love Tatum. He used to go and hear him all the time. And he actually was influenced to the degree where Horowitz used to play for an encore. He had two arrangements that he made. One was on themes from Carmen, and the other was Stars and Stripes Forever. And they were really scary. I mean, they were unbelievable. And Horowitz decided he would do T for Two. So, no, it's a true story. And he went and he worked for months writing out these phenomenally difficult virtuoso variations on T for Two. And then he called Tatum and asked him up, and he played it for him. And Tatum said, yeah, you know, terrific, marvelous, unbelievably difficult. And he said, would you like me to play T for Two? And Horowitz said, yeah. So Tatum then played T for Two until Horowitz stopped him. You know, I mean, he just went on and on and on and on. And Horowitz said, well, when did you figure that out? And Tatum said, well, just now. See, and that, of course, that is, of course, the big trick and the big secret.
Yeah, so that's pretty interesting, that interview. And there are 6 parts, I believe, to that interview on the channel. Oh, okay. The channel is Another Bites the Crust UK. That's the one, yeah. It's actually at Another Bites the Crust UK, actually. Yeah, it's the ampersand symbol in front of it. So, but then this mix is not, this is not the right mix to play all of those parts. This has part 2 on this mix, but you to get all 6 parts, you go to the channel Ampersand Another Bites the Crust UK, and it's on that channel on YouTube. Okay, so what I realized after I talked about what a great pianist Oscar Peterson was in a previous video, I realized that perhaps not only that, but I perhaps should have qualified it by saying the greatest jazz pianist, perhaps, or I mean that I was talking about many people consider him one of the greatest pianists, but I should have perhaps said jazz pianist. And there are other classical pianists, of course, who would have been technically equal or on a similar level of having the speed with their hands, you know, and that sort of thing. So it's not strictly, you know, I mean, it's not, he was in the jazz genre of music, and so that's perhaps the place where the comparison should have been made. But anyway, there was Horowitz, who was, I believe, a great classical pianist, and that's why he mentioned in this interview Horowitz when he was talking about Art Tatum. I mean, there's too much to cover if we're going to cover all of music and all of piano, you know, all of the great piano players and or pianists, whatever you want to call them. There would be too much to cover, but that was, for me, very interesting because I'm Canadian and Oscar Peterson was a very unusual phenomenon as a piano player in Canada, considering the great international success that he achieved. And Canada being such a small country is the reason why it's so unusual. But Oscar Peterson was, I mean, not limited or held back by the fact that Canada was a small country. He won 7 Grammys, which maybe that's as good a testimony as any. We had some more videos yesterday on JW.org, and yeah, it was mentioned, the idea of financial success was mentioned in the case of a brother who had taken up basketball professionally, and he was a considerable talent, but of course there would be financial benefits in any or in many, I should say, in many fields of professional sport and even professional musicians, of course, too. So perhaps Oscar, I was thinking, I mean, this brother that was talked about in the November update, on which I should say brother Bill Turner did a great job. The the point was that in the case of the Italian basketball playing brother, he gave up his career Although he did play for some years while he was still attending meetings of Jehovah's Witnesses, he did eventually, though, you know, actually give up his career. But of course, you know, professional sports careers aren't really that long anyway, so what he was giving up, he felt perhaps he didn't quit early enough in his career. He was a little concerned about that. And I think justifiably so, because the benefits of the truth outweigh the financial benefits of any career that you could imagine. The benefits of being able to say, you know, I stuck to the truth and I, you know, I adhered to it. I felt that I wanted to do what was right, you know, and I wanted to be happy. I wanted to be the happiest I could be, which is what happens when you adhere to the truth. You become happier because you're not deceiving yourself. So this brother did have concerns about that. I'm not sure whether my sentence structure was correct there, but the brother that was mentioned in the November JW Broadcasting was wondering if he did quit his professional sports career early enough. I think that was part of his concern. He does have some second thoughts about that. So the thing is, it's all about really what it boils down to as far as a personal or an individual decision. What it boils down to is your individual decision should only be based on your own happiness. Ultimately, I mean, that's what it comes down to. When you're happy, there's no reason to change your career to become unhappy. That's not what is the reason. The reason would be to become happy. And if you can get more happiness by making a change, well, that would seem that it's a logical thing to do. So you can't always know what's going to make you happier, but when you're helping other people, that's the idea of, well, when you're, the happiness doesn't come from helping other people, but you do help other people. That is a big part of, I think, sharing your happiness, right? You share your happiness by helping other people learn how to do that same thing of being happy. So that magnifies the happiness. I mean, that's the idea behind helping others. And preaching is a way of helping others to teach them how to know the truth about how to be happy. It's really all about being happy. So I don't think it's good to have regrets. So the way to, how do we avoid regrets? I mean, that's the thing. And what Jesus said, I always do the things pleasing to the Father. Remember that? He said that? And that's how I believe is the only way to have no regrets, is to always do the right thing. And the only person who really knows what the right thing is the Creator, Jehovah. Jehovah is simply a name for what Jehovah personifies, which is he causes us to become something more than what we are. He's the Creator. And he's the only one who knows how to make us something more than what we are. How could we know how to become more than what we are? It wouldn't be likely that we could know that, because we only know what we are, if we even know that. Most of us even probably don't even, speaking for myself, we don't even know what we are. Because we're not always completely, it's difficult to be honest with ourselves, so we don't know where we are in terms of who we are. I mean, not where we are, but who we are. We don't know who we are in terms of what actually exactly are we, because we have a lot of DNA, a lot of stuff going on. I thought there was an interesting talk that I have to address, but we'll be considering this on an ongoing basis, I'm sure, from Brother Splane, wherein he talked about Solomon's Ammonite wife. I am expecting a package sometime, maybe today. But I thought the answer to what Brother Splane was saying, he seemed to be referring to the scripture at Deuteronomy. Well, he wasn't seeming to refer to it, but he was actually referring to it in Deuteronomy. But he was seeming to refer to it in a way which implied that it was an ongoing command, where he was saying, even to the 10th generation, none of theirs may come into the congregation of Jehovah to time indefinite, was the reference translation. In the translation he was using, he said, none, even to the 10th generation, none of their descendants may ever come into the congregation of Jehovah. No Ammonite or Moabite may come into the congregation of Jehovah. So he was explaining why or how this could mean that Solomon's Ammonite wife would not be approved. But of course it says to the 10th generation. So the question is, what does that mean, the 10th generation? Would it mean the 10th generation of Israel having arrived at the promised land and 10 generations beyond that? If that's what it means, it would appear that there certainly were 10 generations from the time when they arrived in Canaan in 1452 BCE, 400 and more years later, which would be, well, that would be, the time of Solomon was 1017 for his year one as a king. It's more than 400 years, so divide by 10, you get more than 40 years per generation. That seems like that's more than 10 generations, so that could apply to be the, if that's the point from which we measure the 10 generations, then that would be more than 10 generations. The other thing, though, that's more important is where he was mentioning the time indefinite, or the part about forever. They wouldn't be allowed to come into the congregation until the 10th generation forever, which I took that to mean that he was posing, there was some kind of an implied question there about, does this command apply forever? In other words, this is part of the law of Moses, the five books of the Torah. Deuteronomy is the fifth book of the Torah, which is Moses, the law of Moses. If this applies forever, then that would imply that the law of Moses continues forever. Okay, so what I thought of, at first I didn't really know what to think. Then I thought Jehovah revealed this to me, that Acts 10:24 is the correct response to this. It's not 24. It's Acts chapter 10. It's not did I say 24? Yeah, I did say 24, but I've just written Acts 10. That's not Acts 10, that's Deuteronomy 10. No wonder I'm not finding it. It probably is Acts 10 and 24. Let's just see whether it is or not. That was what my mind, was what Jehovah was telling me in my mind. No, it's not. It's 34. Yeah. Here it is. Peter said, okay, for a certainty I perceive that God is not partial, but in every nation, the man that fears him and works righteousness is acceptable to him. Acceptable. So you can come into the congregation from any nation. In the new covenant, though, this is after Christ abolished the law. This took place when the nations were first introduced into the new covenant, which was the covenant that replaced the law of Moses, was the new covenant. It was the new covenant. And this happened, this event here happened in the year 37 of the Common Era, CE. The Common Era, 37. How do we know that? Well, because it would be logical seeing as there was supposed to be one more week after the crucifixion before the nations would be brought in, the covenant would be extended. Or is it 37? No, wait a minute. No, it's not 37, sorry. It's not 37, it's 33. Correction. It's 33 of the common era, because, and Jesus was crucified in 30. So, but there were 3.5 more, it's 3.5 years after the crucifixion in 30, so it would be later in the year, after the midsummer in 33 CE. 33 of the common era, okay. Yeah, it's 33 CE that this event likely happened anyway. It's not determined exactly, but it's the idea very closely adhering to the scriptures where the 70 weeks of Daniel, and there was going to be the sacrifice at the half of the week, that Jesus would cause sacrifice and gift offering to cease at the half of the week. Okay, and that's why there's 3.5 more years, a week being 7 years, there's 3.5 more years after the crucifixion. So 33 CE is when this event occurred, that the nations were brought in because, and well, we'll look at Daniel just for a moment here, Daniel 9, to see why I'm saying this. This is why I'm saying this. He must keep the covenant, verse 27, Daniel 9, 27. He must keep the covenant in force for the many for 1 week. He must keep the covenant in force for the many for 1 week. Okay? That was from the beginning of Jesus' ministry. The covenant. See, the leader that was coming in verse 26, that was Jesus. If we, you know, interpret it this way, this is how we're interpreting it. Jesus is the Messiah. He is the leader who comes. He keeps the covenant in force for 1 week. That means from the start of his ministry in 26, he started in 26, sometime in the fall of 26 CE. And then 7 years up until 33 in the fall is when this covenant is continued. And the reason why it says continued for the many, meaning, well, that was meaning the covenant. Of the Jews who kept on. They kept on practicing their, I mean, yes, I mean, okay, we're gonna have to study this a lot more than what we've done so far. But for now, it's clear that at the half of the week he will cause sacrifice and gift offering to cease. Okay, at the half of the week he caused sacrifice and gift offering to cease. That means when he was impaled, he abolished the law, which we talked about already. He abolished the law. Right? Now I need to look that up. I mean, this can get very involved, so we're not going to try and do it all today. But well, there's more than one place where it mentions abolish, but this is the one, Galatians. Well, that's another thought. That's a whole different idea. Talking about the promise to Abraham is another thing, which we'll also need to cover that at some point to get it all in context. Abraham was given a promise, then the law of Moses came later. Right? And then the law was not fulfilled until Jesus abolished it by fulfilling it. So all of the Bible, we'll have to get a grip on it. But you see the idea of the half of the week he caused sacrifice and gift offering to cease in verse 27. So that was the significant thing, that the 30 CE when Jesus was crucified, that was the beginning of a new covenant. Or the facilitation of the beginning of that new covenant. It was the end of the old covenant. The old covenant was done away with, and we're not done yet talking about this. But then at the half of the week that happened, so therefore the rest of the week was 3.5 years until the nations were brought in by Peter saying that God is not partial, right? People from every nation What's the noise? There's a noise I don't think should be there. Where's the history? I don't have the history here. Here it is. I don't like that noise. What's the noise? What is it? This? No. Oh. Okay, I know what it is. Yeah. I determined what it was. It was the it's a hard drive enclosure. A Thunderbolt hard drive enclosure that it houses two hard drives. Now I put my hand on it. The noise stopped. Now it's not there anymore. It was a vibration. It stopped it, and then I was able to feel the difference and hear the difference when I put my hand on it. So, these things take time. Okay, we need to realize that study like this takes time, and we have to be strict about it with ourselves. We have to make sure we are not trying to take a shortcut here or anything, you know, that we're actually trying to find the actual truth here. So look at this. So 34 of Acts again. In every nation, the man that fears him and works righteousness is acceptable to him. That's the new covenant. That's part of that's what the bringing of the nations into the new covenant was like. That's what it was to the nations. The new covenant was not just for the Jews alone, it was for the nations, for every nation to be brought in to this new covenant. But how could that be if the old covenant was still in effect, right? It doesn't make sense, especially because it says, in every nation, the man that fears him and works righteousness is acceptable to him. So it doesn't apply to the, there's no restriction on Ammonites, Moabites, or any other groups, no matter what it said in the law of Moses. So let's find out why that could be so, okay? Let's find out why, how we know that. Okay, so I looked up, I remembered where this came from. Deuteronomy 7 and 3, this idea of not marrying. There's the noise again. This idea of forming no marriage alliance in Deuteronomy, it's from Deuteronomy 7 and 3. This was a marriage alliance rule. It was separate from Deuteronomy 17:17, which was, let's look at that first. He should not multiply wives for himself. That was the command. That was talking about a king. In verse 15, they had no king at this point. In Deuteronomy, they still had no king. They didn't even have judges yet. But in the days of Moses, it was prophesied by Moses that they would and should set a king over themselves. And they would, that was verse 15, Deuteronomy 17, 15. So they set a king over themselves. But he should not increase horses for himself, verse 16, and so on. Nor should he multiply wives, verse 17. So, I mean, there are certain rules that he must, you know, follow if he was, because, you know, this is for his benefit and for the benefit of the people, that the problem being that if he were to do those things, he might not be able to do his job as king in a way that would be, you know, pleasing to Jehovah. I think that was it seems that that's clear. That's very clear, right? He wasn't allowed to do that. That was why it was a rule, because Jehovah wouldn't be pleased if he didn't keep that rule. So Solomon, we know, multiplied horses as well as he multiplied wives. He took many wives and he multiplied horses. He did more than one thing wrong. But if we look at this, in Deuteronomy 7 and 3, there was to be no marriage alliance with the people of Canaan, the native Canaanites, or the people who lived in Canaan, who were the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations, all of whom lived in Canaan. They were not to conclude a covenant with them, in verse 2, nor were they to marry the women of those nations, in verse 3. That was because they would turn an Israelite son away from Jehovah. Yeah, the noise stopped again. It's good. Okay, so that was another law that was in the law of Moses. There were laws of Moses. So, but the other thing was, okay, I think this is somewhere, where is it? Yeah, we're going to go back one more chapter, 6 of Deuteronomy. In order that you may fear Jehovah your God so as to keep all his statutes. You see? But we know that Jesus abolished the law, right? Where did we learn that? I thought it was... Oh, I know. It's probably the word abolished. That's what it was. It was probably not the same verb tense, and that's why we didn't find it. Ephesians? Yes, there it is. Ephesians 2 and 15. By means of his flesh, he abolished the enmity. See that? The law. He abolished it. So that he could destroy the wall between the nations and the Jews. That was it. He could reconcile both peoples in verse 16, that he would bring together all the nations together with the Jews in the new covenant. This is the idea of the new covenant also, because the law would be abolished. There would be a new covenant. Well, we could look up new covenant, but that's very well known. I mean, I know that. It's easy to remember from where that comes, from whence that comes. No, whence that comes. Whence that comes would be probably correct grammar there. From where it comes, which is, help me here, Jehovah, 31, Jeremiah. I think it's 31:31. I will conclude with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah a new covenant. That's it there, Jeremiah 31:31. There it is. Okay. So that's the idea of the new covenant. There was going to be a new covenant, so that the old law wasn't going to be abolished and then nothing would be ever happening in the form of any covenant. It wasn't to be... Jehovah wasn't going to abolish the old covenant, never to bring in a new covenant. On the contrary, he was going to bring in a new covenant, and this was the idea that was already known from Jeremiah's prophecy. Okay, so... We know that. We know a lot of things here. We're just trying to get the sense of it. But we also know Jesus abolished the law. And in Deuteronomy 6 and 2, it says, in 6 and 1, these are the commandments, right? That Jehovah your God has commanded to teach you. In verse 2, so as to keep, in order that you may fear Jehovah God. Jehovah your God, so as to keep all his statutes and his commandments. All of them had to be kept. You can't just keep one and not keep all of them. That's the idea. Right? So Jesus did away with all of them and brought in a new covenant. That was the point. So this idea of some scriptures are forever in the law of Moses can't be right because of that. It proves it. So that's, I think, enough of that. Right now, for that particular topic, or that point. I mean, that's just a point that we need to address, right? But we'll have to consider it. The other thing I wanted to say, too, is very interesting point that to me is, and I think it's part of the truth. That's the thing. It's not just whether I think it's right, it's Jehovah. It's whether Jehovah thinks it's correct. The problem with And I'm not sure why I wrote this down. Oh, yes, I did. No, okay. Well, profit, yeah. I know I wrote down another point about profit is no motive for art. You can't be a composer of music if you're doing it for money. I mean, we always used to talk about this when I was younger. We talked about certain musicians had gone commercial. They had sold out to commercial interests. They had decided to make music for the purpose of trying to make money in the, you know, in the world of hit, on the hit parade, you know, in the world of popular music. That's what it was called. That's still probably called, but the pop music, they wanted to become famous and or rich or both, and the way to do that was to compromise your principles and do what the record companies wanted to make the kind of record that the record companies would pay you to make, so that you could make more royalties or you could get more fame and you could get a contract, you know, as well. For starters, you get a contract. Hopefully you become famous. Hopefully you make money. But that was always, we thought of that. We talked about that. Like, they were selling out. They were compromising. You can't make art that way. That's not art. That's just a commercial product. That's not art. That wasn't art to us either. Art was always going to be something you would make where you wouldn't have any profit. There was no profit in making art. That's the point that no one seemed to get. That's why when I made my music, even though at some point we, for some reason, my wife was selling it at the local fair, I don't know why we got into, but we got involved in selling it. It's very strange to me now, because my songs, basically, I don't think I was, that was not the motive for writing my songs at all. It wasn't a commercial motive. It was all about writing the best songs, writing something that was important or that hadn't been written or something. It was all about being truthful in the songs, but being better in terms of content, the lyrical content, as well as, well, everything. It wasn't just that. I enjoyed doing it. I was doing it for my own enjoyment too. It just an incredible beauty that music can convey. The feelings it brings to the composer, musician, recording artist. But it was to share with others, obviously. I mean, if that was what always happened, whenever I made a recording, I would want to share it. So that's why the commercial element comes in. You want to share, therefore you can't just share by going and giving to people, because they don't accept that usually. You have to sell it is the problem, right? It you want to just give it away, so you do that whenever you can. You give it whenever you can. You share it free of charge. That's because you don't want to. You're not doing it for money. That's the whole point. The idea that there is simply that there's no art if there's a profit motive. There's no art. It's got to be without a profit motive. The other thought I had was control is really self-control. The idea was when Solomon was prohibited, you know, from marrying wives of certain nations, the idea was not to control Solomon. It was Solomon should control himself. That was the point, okay? Solomon could lose control of himself because of having too many dealings with unbelievers, you know, with other nations who didn't have the same faith, who didn't believe in Jehovah at all, who didn't have any concept or didn't care about truth. All they cared about was their customs or whatever, you know. They didn't even care about the truth. They just cared about whatever customs. Like people today celebrating all these worldly holidays, birthdays, all these. They don't care about the truth at all. They just care about these holidays. They don't care about the truth. What's true or false, they don't care. They just care about holidays. You know, I mean, that idea, is an example. It's just one example. There are many things like that in the world that people don't care about the truth. So this idea of control is about self-control. It's about self-control. That's the thought I had. Okay, so if you can keep all the commands of the law, that wouldn't help you nowadays, right? Because we're not under that law anymore. That's been abolished. We're under the new covenant now. But it was put in place to demonstrate who could control himself well enough to obey all those things. And Solomon's sin was not that he chose to go with a certain wife, although, you know, maybe that was one of his sins, but it wasn't his only sin. His sin was he disobeyed the rule about multiplying horses and wives at the same time, which led to his demise, right? In the law of Moses in Deuteronomy 17:17, talking about, and the surrounding verses talking about what the king should or shouldn't do in order for him to exercise self-control. It wasn't that Jehovah was saying, you know, this was necessary because Jehovah didn't like horses. That's not what Jehovah was saying. It's not that Jehovah didn't like women. He should also not multiply wives for himself. Verse 17:17. But verse 16, he should not increase horses for himself. Nor should he increase silver and gold for himself very much. He was told not to become rich. You see that? That's in verse 17, right? So that's why the profit motive never works, even till today, even nowadays. But the same idea about bad associations spoil useful habits. Bad associations spoil useful habits. That's why we don't want to associate with anybody who doesn't believe in Jehovah at all. We just don't want to associate with those people because it's a bad associate who can spoil our useful habits, right? So it's about self-control, though. These things that we're saying, I mean, if you couldn't obey all the commands of all of the whole law of Moses and everything, if you couldn't obey all of the commands of Jehovah, then you couldn't control yourself, in other words, right? You couldn't control yourself enough to read the law, and you couldn't control yourself enough to remember to do it correctly. I mean, it was about self-control, not about Jehovah exercising control over you. That's the point that I see there. Okay, so yeah, that's good. I think that covered what I was trying to say, what I thought of. Made a few notes last night as I was lying in bed there. Oh, I started up my iPad this morning. My old iPad this morning, it was 89% after whatever time it's been since I got my new iPad. I'll check that out to see how long it takes for the battery to fall from 100% to 89%. It's been a couple months, hasn't it, or something like that? When did I get the new iPad? Well, I know, I probably have a record. Yeah, I need to look it up right now before I forget to, or before I... The new one, page 159, okay. New iPad, page 159, so this is the first occurrence of this. It's new. Good. And that was September. So, it's not even been 2 months yet. It's getting to 2 months. No, it's not 2 months. It's like a month and a half. So after a month and a half, that battery went down from 100% with the old iPad turned off. The battery fell to 89% after a month and a half. So the battery still works fine. It charges up to 100% after a few minutes, really, or seemed like relatively few minutes. So then I turned it off again. So now I'm not going to use the old iPad all the time, but it works fine. It's a backup iPad, and I'm just concerned that I'm acquiring too many possessions. But my fear was that I don't want to have an iPad fail on me and not have a backup in case. But you can take it too far. That's the problem. We can take these things too far where we want to have a backup plan for everything. And at some point you have to say, I'm going to trust in Jehovah to provide for me. I'm not going to worry about it. But, I mean, I'm trying to get my supply of matcha tea now and figure that out. And I found out I can get Do Matcha, which is my brand that I was using. I can get the same brand on Amazon, apparently, in bulk, for a reasonable price, too. I want to order that. So that's what I'm thinking of doing. But the problem is, whenever they don't deliver something immediately, seems like it's not. If it's not going to be delivered in the next few days, there's more worries about whether it will ever arrive and that sort of thing. What was I thinking? Yeah, we should be happy. We need to rejoice in all the things that happen. We need to, you know, if somebody. The other thing is, not everything goes well. Sometimes we're going to lose money. That's just the way life is. We are going to lose money sometimes. It's just going to happen. And take we should, or could, can, I believe we should, take it as discipline. When we lose money, we take it as, we can, and I do try to take it as discipline. I will take it as discipline. It's discipline. Without that loss of money, I would never have sobered up to the reality, figuratively speaking, sobered up in the sense of realize that, wait a minute, not everything is going to be perfect, you know, and it doesn't have to be perfect. That's the thing to realize. Nothing, not that nothing has to be perfect, not everything has to be perfect. Not everything has to be perfect. And that's where you get into designing, and when you're designing and building things, not everything is perfect. There are a lot of things, I wouldn't say compromises, but a lot of things that happen that are beyond your control. They're not compromises. They're just things that are beyond your control. And you just take them in stride and you go with the flow. You know, you make it work no matter what. You take it as, and you always turn it into an advantage. So something went wrong, but that's going to be an advantage. It's always an advantage. In some other way of doing it. It's an advantage to some other choices that you make. It's going to be an advantage. If you just slightly adjust what you're doing, it's going to enable you to make, in some cases, to rule out certain possibilities, right? So if you can rule those things out, then you can make a choice on what you should do much more easily because you can rule those things out. Well, example, for example, that really good example of, well, I'm not going to try to make money. You rule out the profit motive. That makes it easier to decide what you're going to do. Because you at least you know you're not going to do that. You're ruling out that one thing, you see. So, like, Solomon was not supposed to be rich. But he was rich. He was going down and taking gold, you know, from places. The gold of Ophir was talked about in the Bible. You know, Solomon used to go and bring in ships full of gold and stuff. He was rich in bringing in lots and lots of money or gold, but also other things too. He was bringing in shipments of all sorts of things were coming in that he was sending out ships to bring things back so that he would be wealthy and multiplying his wealth. Those were things that he shouldn't have been doing, too. So, the thing is, how do we get happiness? That's really the point, I think, is what the real point is. And it helps a lot if we're seeking the truth. It helps to get happiness, to seek the truth. I'm nearly at the end of this study here. Our study is nearly over. A Melody of David to bring to remembrance, little children. This is our psalm. Let's pray. Jehovah, help us to remember your commandments that you gave to your people Israel of record in ancient times, and also to understand that we need to learn about your new covenant and to appreciate that every nation is welcome under the new covenant. For those who are rightly disposed in their fear of you, in Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so listen, this is Psalm 38, little children. O Jehovah, do not in your indignation reprove me, nor in your rage correct me. For your own arrows have sunk themselves deep into me, and upon me your hand is come down. There is no sound spot in my flesh because of your denunciation. There is no peace in my bones on account of my sin, for my own errors have passed over my head like a heavy load. They are too heavy for me. My wounds have become stinky. They have festered because of my foolishness. I have become disconcerted. I have bowed low to an extreme degree. All day long I have walked about sad. For my very loins have become full of burning, and there is no sound spot in my flesh. I have grown numb and become crushed to an extreme degree. I have roared due to the groaning of my heart. O Jehovah, in front of you is all my desire, and from you my sighing itself has not been concealed. My own heart has palpitated heavily. My power has left me, and the light of my own eyes also is not with me. As for my lovers and my companions, they keep standing away from my plague, and my close acquaintances themselves have stood off at a distance. But those seeking my soul lay out traps, and those working for a calamity to me have spoken of adversities. And deceptions they keep muttering all day long. As for me, like someone deaf, I would not listen, and like someone speechless, I would not open my mouth. And I came to be like a man that was not hearing, and in my mouth there were no counter arguments. For on you, O Jehovah, I waited. You yourself proceeded to answer, O Jehovah, my God, for I said otherwise they would rejoice at me. When my foot moved unsteadily, they would certainly assume great airs against me. For I was ready to limp, and my pain was in front of me constantly. For I proceeded to tell about my own error, and I began to be anxious over my sin. And my enemies, who were alive, became mighty, and those hating me for no reason became many. And they were rewarding me with bad for good. They kept resisting me in return for my pursuing what is good. Do not leave me, O Jehovah. O my God, do not keep far away from me. Do make haste to my assistance, O Jehovah, my salvation. Psalm 38. That was wonderful. This is how it feels when we seek the truth. We feel like people want to do harm to us for no reason. It's interesting. It's not really interesting because we don't want to think about it. But it's strange. Those hating me for no reason became many, and they kept resisting me. Verse 20, 19 and 20 of Psalm 38. They kept resisting me in return for my pursuing what is good. When we pursue what is good, there will be people who will resist us for that very reason, that we are pursuing what is good, is what that says. Isaiah 18. Ha! For the land of the whirring insects with wings, which is in the region of the rivers of Ethiopia. It is the one sending forth envoys by means of the sea and by means of vessels of papyrus upon the surface of the waters, saying, Go, you swift messengers, to a nation drawn out and scoured. to a people fear-inspiring everywhere, a nation of tensile strength and of treading down whose land the rivers have washed away. All you inhabitants of the productive land and you residents of the earth, you will see a sight, just as when there is the raising up of a signal upon the mountains, and you will hear a sound, just as when there is the blowing of a horn. For this is what Jehovah has said to me: I will keep undisturbed and look upon my established place like the dazzling heat along with the light, like the cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, when the blossom comes to perfection and the bloom becomes a ripening grape, one must also cut off the sprigs with pruning shears and must remove the tendrils, must lop them off. They will be left altogether for the bird of prey of the mountains and for the beast of the earth. And upon it the bird of prey will certainly pass the summer, and upon it even every beast of the earth will pass the harvest time. In that time a gift will be brought to Jehovah of armies from a people drawn out and scoured, even from a people fear-inspiring everywhere, a nation of tensile strength and of treading down, whose land the rivers have washed away, to the place of the name of Jehovah of armies, Mount Zion. That was Isaiah 18. Before the blossom comes to perfection, verse 5, one must also cut off the sprigs with pruning shears, and they will be left altogether for the bird of prey of the mountains. And upon it, they will pass the summer, it says. So, that's an interesting thought about, it sounds like it's talking about the feeding of these animals. But then the gift brought to Jehovah would be brought from this people, fear-inspiring everywhere, which was also mentioned in verse 2. Go, messengers, to a people fear-inspiring everywhere, a nation of tensile strength. But this is interesting. The gift would be brought to Jehovah of armies from this people who were fear-inspiring and also of tensile strength. That's Isaiah 18. So, what about John? Can we do that? We seem to be leaving it right to the last minute here. 18 of John. Not 19. 18 of John. Jesus gets arrested here in this chapter. So I think we better, we'll have to do this today sometime. I have to go out today. So, can we read this in 6 minutes? Having said these things, Jesus went out with his disciples across the winter torrent of Kidron to where there was a garden, and he and his disciples entered into it. Now Judas, his betrayer, also knew the place, because Jesus had many times met there with his disciples. Therefore Judas took the soldier band and officers of the chief priests and of the Pharisees and came there with torches and lamps and weapons. Jesus, therefore, knowing all the things coming upon him, went forth and said to him, "Whom are you looking for?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." Now Judas, his betrayer, was also standing with them. However, when he said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Therefore he asked them again, "Whom are you looking for?" They said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you I am he. If therefore it is I you are looking for, let these go, in order that the word might be fulfilled which he said, 'Of those whom you have given me, I have not lost a single one.'" Then Simon Peter, as he had a sword, drew it and struck the slave of the high priest and cut his right ear off. The name of the slave was Malchus. Jesus, however, said to Peter, "Put the sword into its sheath. The cup that the Father has given me, should I not by all means drink it?" Then the soldier band and the military commander and the officers of the Jews seized Jesus and bound him. And they led him first to Annas, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. And Caiaphas was, in fact, the one that counseled the Jews that it was to their benefit for one man to die in behalf of the people. Now Simon Peter, as well as another disciple, was following Jesus. That disciple was known to the high priest, and he went in with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter was standing outside at the door. Therefore the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. The servant girl, the doorkeeper, then said to Peter, "You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I'm not." Now the slaves and the officers were standing about, as they had built a charcoal fire, because it was cold, and they were warming themselves. Peter also was standing with them and warming himself. And so the chief priests questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered him, "I have spoken to the world publicly. I always taught in a synagogue and in the temple where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. See, these know what I said." After he said these things, one of the officers that was standing by gave Jesus a slap in the face and said, "Is that the way you answer the chief priests?" Jesus answered him, "If I spoke wrongly, bear witness concerning the wrong, but if rightly, why do you hit me?" Then Annas sent him away bound to Caiaphas the high priest. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself, and they said to him, "You are not also one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the man whose ear Peter cut off, said, "I saw you in the garden with him, did I not?" However, Peter denied it again, and immediately a cock crowed. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the governor's palace. It was now early in the day, but they themselves did not enter into the governor's palace, that they might not get defiled, but might eat the Passover. Therefore Pilate came outside to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" In answer they said to him, "If this man were not a wrongdoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." Hence Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to kill anyone." This in order that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he said to signify what sort of death he was destined to die. So Pilate entered into the governor's palace again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Is it of your own originality that you say this, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you up to me. What did you do?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is no part of this world. If my kingdom were part of this world, my attendants would have fought that I should not be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not from this source." Therefore Pilate said to him, "Well then, are you a king?" Jesus answered, "You yourself are saying that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone that is on the side of the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And after saying this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no fault in him. Moreover, you have a custom that I should release a man to you at the Passover. Do you therefore wish me to release to you the king of the Jews?" Then they shouted, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. That was John chapter 18. So, the prophecy Jesus gave about Peter denying him three times before a cock crowed was actually fulfilled during this time period of Jesus' arrest and trial. And there is some more prophecy that was fulfilled here about Jesus not losing a single one of his disciples because they were not arrested along with him. The idea that there are many prophecies here actually that we can eventually discuss later on about the idea that of the sword being there, that they would have a sword with them. What was another prophecy about them being with Jesus being counted with lawless ones and so on. But there are many prophecies about the Messiah that were to be fulfilled by Jesus, that were fulfilled throughout his life, including in this phase of his life too. So this is Word Green. It's November 8th, 2022. I want to go out today, possibly, do a bit of shopping, get some food. It's 11:59 hours, November 8th, 2022. Thank you for watching and listening, and praise Jehovah. Have a great day. Bye for now.